afternoon released opening guidelines, and folks were pretty excited about the prospect of getting back to business a lot sooner than expected. Those guidelines have been published. They are on the City of Los Angeles' website, and they work in synergy to a great extent with what's been issued in the county and what's been issued in the state there. So for those that are, you know, obviously operating in California, paying close attention to those. I know there's a lot of things that people are working through besides all the other issues that have been presented the last few days in getting back to opening, but the guidelines have been published and resumption to normal business or somewhat normal business as soon as possible is what the hope is for everybody in Los Angeles and elsewhere. Lee, are you able to hear me okay now?
I can hear you.
Okay, great. Sorry about that. We lost you there for a second.
So can you hear me?
As you were saying, West Hollywood, you know, has been spared, but you suffered some pretty, and Santa Monica suffered some pretty extensive damage.
Not too bad compared to others. We'll be okay. Just got broken into and a little bit of looting, but luckily we were able to protect West Hollywood, and we're going day by day. It seems like it's getting a little better, but there's some protests planned for today, and we'll see. We're just talking to the authorities and people we know and trying to weave and get through this.
Well, and Innovative Dining Group, I can't think of a restaurant group that's more known, for the place to be and to have a great dining experience with friends and others, a very, highly social environment. How have you dealt with the coronavirus with your restaurants, from March until now? I know you've done some pretty innovative things with your offerings and to-go meals and that sort of thing. What have you been doing so far that's been working for you?
Yeah, I think, really quickly we decided to pivot and, much like a lot of the other restaurants around the country, focus obviously on delivery where we could and curbside pickup. Like many others, we developed a Boa Raw program where you could buy steaks from us to cook at home. We, did a Boa Market so you could buy produce and pantry items like others, but we also saw that it's difficult to order on an app for a family, and yet you're sitting there, you're the only one with the menu and you're picking all these items. So we decided to really do several like family packs, and we'd launched like a sushi platter for four or bento boxes, combo plates at Boa where it comes with your protein and two sides. And these have been super popular, and I think it's something that will live after COVID. We've even done like roll your own hand roll from the Japanese restaurants. Also pre-prepared meals. We did a huge Seder for Passover. I think we did 180 meals just for Passover, which was great. We did the same thing for Easter and Mother's Day. And also done the pre-mixed specialty cocktail. So not that different than anyone else, but it's just getting going really quickly and adapting almost every day. We have a team meeting every morning at 10 a.m. and we kind of look at what's working, what's not, and try new things right away. Whereas normally things would take, a month to launch. We're launching things weekly.
Well, and for those that haven't taken a look at your website, I certainly recommend doing so. I'm looking at some of your, prepared and to go offerings. It's really impressive. And some of the meals you're serving hot to go, like in the family packs.
Yeah, we're doing both. For sushi, we started just with cold and then we added hot, and then we added the combo of hot and cold. We have a little bit of everything. We're trying things and we see what people love. And we've also been trying other restaurants and seeing what we like that other people are doing and learning from, our friends and neighbors. And, one thing that this crisis has done is it's brought all the restaurateurs really close together. I mean, you always had your friends that are fellow restaurateurs, but now you're on Zoom calls or WhatsApp with, all of your competitors, and you're all talking and you're all in the same place. And whether it's nationally or locally, it's really interesting. And these are like friendships that are going to continue, I think.
Yeah. And have you been using third party delivery beforehand at all? Do you have any reason to do that, or are you using it now?
Definitely. It's something that's been changing a little bit, but right now we're with Postmates and DoorDash and Uber Eats. I think we let Grubhub go, and we're also pushing the curbside because the curbside, you know, we don't have that delivery fee that the guest really doesn't realize. And people like the idea of seeing who's serving their food and keeping it clean. And I think curbside is something that's going to be, we talked about it before this, and it was kind of something that we always put on hold. And I think now it's going to be something that we embrace and we do, you know, we set ourselves up for the future and push this idea of, you know, grabbing food on your way home.
Well, now that you're able to bring guests back in the restaurants in a number of your locations, I mean, how are you approaching that? You know, and how are things kind of, you know, looking from your perspective as you move into kind of the summer season?
Yeah. So on the macro level, we have to, you know, the new world, which we don't know what it's going to look like. We need to be super lean and we need to be super efficient. So, you know, we obviously at the restaurant level, we're doing all the health protocols, and each city or county is a little different. You know, what we do in Arizona is a little bit different than what we'll do in Newport and LA or Vegas. But, you know, we're going to do temperature checks, or we're doing temperature checks for all employees, health checks. We have a sign outside for the guests that, you know, if you're displaying any symptoms, please go home and get better and join us another day. We're doing all the sanitization type stuff, masks for everyone, obviously. And even if the area doesn't require that necessarily, like Arizona, we're doing it because we want to set a standard. And we feel that, you know, while it might turn off some people, which it has, it's going to keep the other people safe. And there's different waves of people going out. You know, right now it's the people that really, you know, are fine with it or don't care or not worried. And then I think it'll open up more and more as time goes by, and those people might care a little more. So I think we have to set the example and, you know, what our brand is, which is being professional. And I think the best brands will do that. So, you know, reducing costs. We, you know, for the first time in 20 years, we're outsourcing accounting and payroll. And, you know, that was a tough decision to make, you know, because there's a lot of folks that worked with us for a long time, but it's something that's the future and being efficient and, you know, we need to reduce our overhead. Delivery, like I said, will remain, and, you know, LA is allowed to open now, but we can't really open with the protests. So we're going to cascade those in when we can. Arizona's open, Newport's open, and actually doing really well. So people are out and about. People are appreciative of the things we're doing, the protocols, and they're happy to be there and support. And a lot of our regulars are back. Vegas is a different animal, and we'll see. We're allowed to open there now, but I don't think we can, because who's going to Vegas right now? So that's a big question mark. So I think that's it. One more thing that's going to be, we just are in the midst of launching our first cloud kitchen. So we're going to expand the delivery area of BOA, basically. So, you know, there's like a 3-mile or 15-minute radius for delivery around a restaurant. And what a cloud kitchen enables you to do is do it in a different zone. So we're working with cloud kitchen, and we're going to be able to now deliver much farther east than our restaurant in West Hollywood. And that's going to be launching July 1st. So if that works, and we just don't know until we see it, it'll be something that helps us expand.
Well, and Lee, I really appreciate the time today, and, you know, consistent with our theme, Don't Stop Believing, we were talking, you know, before the call about your optimism for the restaurant industry. What keeps you believing in the restaurant industry?
You know, at the end of the day, you can't celebrate the same way at home as you can out and about, being taken care of. And I think that people will want to go out again. I think people are craving being around friends and celebrating. How many great things happen at all of our restaurants? So, you know, there will be a new normal. It will be different, just like TSA is different than pre-9/11. And I think that people will embrace it. It's going to take some while, and it's going to be bumpy and rocky until we get there. But people are going to be out and about, and they're going to be dining at the places they trust. They're going to be going out for the experience. They know that they can just grab food and eat at home, but that's like a 5-minute experience versus being out and being taken care of with the music and the lights and the people and the energy. And that's kind of what's been our success over the years. And so I think we're in a good position given that. I mean, we're very stressed, but I think we're optimistic that we'll come out of this stronger than we ever were.
Well, Lee, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to speak with us today, and fellow restaurateurs on the call, you know, thinking of you and your team during this time, and can't wait to get things back to to a state of normal. For those that have not visited your restaurants, do yourself a favor and do so when we're all able to return. You and your team do an amazing job, Lee, and appreciate all that you do.
Thanks, Riley. Appreciate you doing this. It's important to keep us in this, and you know, we're all in it together. So thanks a lot.
Well, thanks again, Lee. And for those that have not had a chance to take a look at Innovative Dining Group's website or visit the restaurants, really recommend that you do so. They've been in business since 1997 and have really been a market leader in the segments that they're in and attracting guests from all over the world to their restaurants and best-in-class hospitality and all the key aspects of the business. So please take a look if you can. And now I'd like to introduce, I think we have her on the phone at the moment, Martha Hoover, founder of Patachute Inc. Martha, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Riley. Thank you for having us.
Well, Martha, it's a real pleasure to have you. We've gotten to know each other pretty well over the last several years, and I've been a big fan of your business, as are others on the call and others around the country, to see what you have been doing from the heartland of America, from Indianapolis, through Cafe Patachute and your other restaurants has been really impressive. And I think one thing that's really struck me, and it comes through for those on the call, please visit Cafe Patachute or Patachute Inc. Website to get more information about Martha's company. But you've always been ahead of the curve in terms of what people are focusing on now. You were focusing back on when you opened up in 1989. So you've been at this, you were one of the pioneers of all the things that people are now finally realizing are really important. But now, before we get into that, I know it's been kind of a difficult past few days in Indianapolis. Tell us what's been going on there, and how are things from your perspective?
Well, thank you, Riley. We have 12 locations spread out through the city of Indianapolis, and the city of Indianapolis is actually the greater metropolitan area is divided into two different counties. So we have two different jurisdictions, each of which have different mandates and different rules and regulations for restaurants, particularly for how restaurants are being reopened. Three of our 12 locations are located in the heart of downtown in Indianapolis, Indiana, and two of those three restaurants received between Friday night and Saturday night as part of the demonstrations that spun off and created a very violent situation. We had vandalism and looting at two of the locations and have had to deal with the aftermath of that. We have three locations that are located in a mall environment, and due to threats to the mall for some disruptive protests, the malls have been the mall that we're in has been closed. It was closed early on Saturday, remained closed Sunday, and is remaining closed until we think tomorrow. We're not sure. And that came at a time right when we were reopening those locations in the mall for carryout, curbside, and patio dining in compliance with our Marion County mandates. So that's where we are. We've had, we're moving forward, trying to work with landlords. Now we've got a new issue regarding storefronts that are damaged, completely damaged, interiors that have been ruined, inventory that has been lost, not necessarily, not because of COVID, but because of the recent demonstrations. And then we also are, we're not on the line at all. We've been in support of the peaceful protest. We have members of our team who've been out there. We have former Army medics who are in part of our team. We've been supplying medical supplies to the medic stations for the peaceful protesters. So we find ourselves with a perspective in this protest that, you know, is just intersected with a lot of different thoughts. And we're also a little bit at odds with our landlords on that as well. So that's what we're doing right now. We are trying to get out to the other side of COVID. We've actually never shut down completely. Our executive and leadership team has been working since March 16th, when the governor of Indiana mandated that we close all restaurants. We took a breather at the operational level of a couple of weeks to assess what we needed to do. We did not automatically jump into the carryout model. We did not automatically jump into the curbside pickup or the delivery model. We decided that what we needed to do had to have tremendous intentionality and not be a quick pivot, that we needed, obviously, everyone says first and foremost to protect staff, but that really was, that's true for everybody. But we also needed to make sure that what we were doing in the carryout or grocery model or curbside or delivery models matched our customers' expectation regarding what they thought of the company in terms of our customer relationships and our customer service. And we needed to do something also that distinguished our product, our packaging, the entire experience from all the chatter that was out there, because everyone was doing the same thing. And we needed to make sure that we stood out among all the chatter.
Oh, and Martha, you have always, been a leader in the space, and certainly your tagline, says a lot: radically different, radically better.
We've actually added radically optimistic to that tagline.
Okay. Well, and that's impressive in itself during these times. I would expect nothing less from you and your team. You have been very active, since 1989 in really leading food forward and doing so from, a part of the country that's, maybe not known for, progressive food as some other places, which is impressive in its own right. I wanted to talk a little bit about your 2020 vision, though, and how that fits into the kind of the culture of your company and your guidelines to be better.
Yeah, like 12 years ago, we came up with the 2020 vision, and then lo and behold, what happened, 2020 came. And knowing that we were heading into 2020, part of 2019 was spent on updating that vision. And we started working at an all-team level in defining what we wanted the company to look like at the end of 2024. And the COVID hard operational pause, although it was of limited tenure, really gave us the opportunity to deep dive in that work. And so we came up with this 2024 vision through a lot of stakeholder meetings and work. But between COVID and what's going on now with social unrest and people's awareness level, we decided to take the vision in a completely different direction but we decided to branch off from the 2020 vision. What we're trying to do moving forward is to build a higher performing organization in four very specific areas. One, we want to develop purposeful leaders. We want to transform as a second component. We want to transform our management practices. We want to also, probably very critically, deliver superior economic results, not just for the company, but for our team leaders, for our employees, which of course impacts our fourth item that we are so interested in creating higher optimization, and that is the amplification of our social impact in the community. We have decided as a team that it is critically important that we move away from this idea that livable wage is the high standard. We understand, we do a lot of poverty simulation. We have a Potter Shoe Foundation that works with the extreme poor in our community. And we just look at livable wage as being another word for survival wage. And we want to make sure that we build in systems that allow collectively for people in the restaurant community, particularly in the restaurants that we have impact in, our own restaurants, for them to actually earn a level of prosperity and security that is not endemic in the restaurant business as it exists today. You know, all industries are having to adapt to a new reality, and that new reality demands flexibility, resilience, and creativity. And what I'm hearing from restaurateurs around the country and what we are trying to embrace is the ability to be remarkably creative. And we've taken the task of being creative, it goes way beyond coming up with an edited menu or a menu for grocery items. We are starting with every meeting with upending the assumptions that we have lived under for the last, you know, 30 years. The main assumption being that restaurants are physical spaces that people come to. So we are, you know, we are just analyzing everything we do to see how we can do it better, more organized, more efficiently, creating less waste, and giving not just the company, but the people who work for the company greater security.
And Martha, you know, you have your one of your primary brands is Cafe Padded Shoe, and you know, very popular, you know, and has been for a long time. You know, the hot spot for breakfast, lunch, and brunch. You were in expansion mode, and you know, we're contemplating, you know, even further growth. Is that still something that's you know, at the forefront for you as you move ahead out of COVID?
100%. We all know that we can expect to see real estate opportunities come out of COVID. We're not usually bottom feeders, and we normally like A properties. We put a lot of money into our physical spaces. But at the same time, we know that Cafe Potter Shoe as a brand has a particular ethos that's been part of the company since 1989 that is remarkably relevant today. And beyond the fact that the food that we serve is awesome and excellent, and you know, Cafe Potter Shoe, we believe all the benchmarks for expansion, at least regionally in the you know, in the tri-state area surrounding Indiana. So yes, we are still moving ahead on our plans. We also, it's kind of funny, you know, we were mandated to close on March 16th. We all got really hijacked immediately by COVID. And it took a beat for us to really figure out what the steps were going to be for the company. On March 23rd, I had a Zoom call where we came up with it first as a joke, and March 22nd was a Sunday. The Zoom call was on a Sunday. We came up with the idea to take a space that we have that had been shuttered, and we were going to open it up as Apocalypse Burger. That night at 10:30 at night, I had our trademark lawyer on the phone. We were, you know, tightening that up legally. The next day we were talking about menu. We're getting ready to open that as a carryout restaurant, as a sole carryout restaurant only. We open up next week. We've been waiting for equipment and of course Board of Health and Fire Marshal approval, which because of COVID, everyone has been in tremendous slow mode. So we just got that this week, and we're opening up a new concept next week. I don't believe that now is the time for us to just stand still in the middle of some status quo, you know, saying, hey, we're just going to hold tight. We've got tremendous talent within the company. We know that we are not able today to bring everybody back, but we think that we can strategically map out a plan for reopenings, map out a plan for this new concept, map out a plan for expansion that really works with the future of restaurants and the future of what consumers want.
Well, and to those that are looking at, you know, investing or being part of the Patichou growth plan, you know, why are you so radically optimistic? And I know why, but you know, to those out there, you know, why bullish on Patichou from your perspective?
Well, Patichou has a 30-year history, so I think in restaurant world we're considered a historic brand, and that's really critically important because we're a historic brand, but we have always maintained relevancy. And so many restaurants, especially as they age, lose their relevancy. They work too hard to stay right in the middle of trend. And the problem with trends, of course, is that they go away, and they go away very quickly. We've always been, people say we've been ahead of the curve. What we've really been is ahead of the trend. And we've been ahead of the trend regarding our food quality, our food sourcing, our customer experience, our commitment to environmental sustainability. We've had, for instance, a person on our staff who's been the director of environmental sustainability for 8 years. She's in a PhD program at Harvard in restaurant sustainability, has a master's degree from the University of Gastronomic Science. It's not a new position with us. We have had things in the company called the Peer Fund, the Patichou Employee Emergency Relief Fund, which was established 7 years ago and funded, seeded by the company, and was for the purpose of helping our staff, even if they work for 1 hour a week or a million hours a week. Everyone had access to the fund, and it was a fund that helped people during their financially stressful times. And of course, financially stressful 6 years ago could have been a flat tire on the way to work. Today, that definition has been significantly changed. Since March 16th, the Peer Fund has given out almost $100,000 of funds. We're just doing things that I think a lot of restaurants are just waking up to. And I'm really proud of the fact that we've been doing them, but I have to put it in context. I'd never worked in a restaurant, not one day in my life. When I opened my first restaurant, I had been a former sex crimes prosecutor at a time when we were the second sex crimes unit to be formed in the United States. So we were disrupting that whole area of law. And that kind of set a DNA print in my brain that I could do anything without having any real base knowledge. And I say that very openly. I didn't work in a restaurant. I'm not a chef. I'm not formally trained. So when I opened up my first restaurant, I did not know that it was pioneering or disruptive in any way to establish some of the things that we established. I just thought it was the right thing to do, and that's what we did. So we've kind of upended a traditional restaurant model from 1989 on, not knowing that that's what we were doing. And that gives us a bit of an advantage because our teams are really comfortable with the idea of meaningful change and the process of change. And I think most restaurants have been thrown into this change model right now, and it's difficult if you've not talked very openly, not just about why you're changing, the need for change, but how you institute change. It does not happen quickly. It does not happen overnight. And you really have to, you know, to work at making meaningful and impactful change part of your daily existence, or you get a lot of roadblocks thrown your way.
Well, Martha, I can't thank you enough for spending the time with us today and talking to a group of fellow restaurateurs and others on the call.
It's an honor.
Really appreciate your vision, your leadership, and you know, thinking of you and your team as we work through these next few weeks. And thank you again for sharing your time and perspective with us. You do tremendous work.
Well, thank you. It's been an honor to be on the call, and I'm going to stick around and learn from everybody else. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you, Martha. And for those that have not had a chance to take a look at Patichou's website, they actually have two, the corporate site Patichou Inc. and also for Cafe Patichou. A lot of great information there. So recommend that everybody takes a look and, you know, learn from what Martha and her team have been doing currently and over the years. Very, very
thank
much
you.
Ahead of the curve in all respects. Thank you, Martha.
Thank you.
Next, we're going to move into a quick overview of, you know, buying a business out of distress. We're seeing a lot more activity on the distress side. All you need to do is look at the headlines coming through on the various restaurant news publications every morning about companies filing for bankruptcy or going out of business or buyers emerging to purchase assets of companies in bankruptcy and so forth. So we'll be doing a separate webinar within the next few days on this very specific topic. We've also, on some of our prior calls, talked about managing a business in distress, which is front and center on pretty much everybody's mind out there these days, and how to work through those issues. So if you're somebody that has a company that's in distress mode and you're looking at different options, obviously our team here at DWT can help with those things, whether it's a Chapter 7 or Chapter 11 process or an assignment for benefit of creditors or something else in terms of unwinding. But on the purchase side, what we're starting to see, as well as on the finance side, we're starting to see at least some level of normalization, at least we were over the past week or so. And I think that trend is probably going to continue for some time as restaurants begin to reopen and things start to get a little more clear on the investment side. We're also starting to see more interest in different types of deals in terms of joint ventures and alternative development models. For those that have not tried joint ventures or related types of models, you know, those are also something that we can assist with, because there's a lot of ways to develop in ways that are not as capital intensive as putting in your own capital or opening corporate stores. There's also licensing, there's franchising, and other models that are sparking renewed interest. But in terms of purchasing a distressed business, you know, some key high-level points. You know, one of the things, there was, you know, a transaction that was noted, you know, quite broadly over the last few days involving the purchase of some LPQ units. And people were saying, wow, how did that come together so quickly? And how did, you know, they negotiate a deal to buy all these restaurants for such a low price? You know, there are a lot of conversations that are going on behind the scenes with different brands all over the place at any given time. So, you know, it's to get into the middle of those conversations, it's good to know the right people, the right contacts. So if there's a brand that you're interested in that you know is having a difficult time or might otherwise want to sell, you know, getting in contact with them is really a first step and understanding if there's a deal to potentially be had. Once you get into the kind of the conversations about an opportunity, it's really important to understand kind of how these processes may play out, because when you're dealing with a distressed business, often there are a number of liabilities that a buyer would not want to assume, and often the only way to relieve oneself of any liability in terms of a purchase is to go through a formal bankruptcy process. Otherwise, there may be successor liability claims that may be a persistent problem for you, and an indemnification and other provisions in any agreement might not be sufficient to cover those. And what we mean here is claims such as, you know, lawsuits or wage and hour related claims or certain tax claims or other things that might survive any type of transaction that the buyer may be on the hook for. So a bankruptcy process may be the only way to effectively purchase the turnkey liens, claims, and successor liability. And for those in California and some of these other markets, this can become really critical, especially on wage and hour related claims, to not be stepping into any liability, because those can be very significant. Also really important, and I'm sure it's counterintuitive at this point, is the real estate situation. You know, a bankruptcy process may allow you to assume leases. That means step in, but you probably don't want to step into a lot of leases right now, because the terms probably aren't the types of terms that you would want. Now, there's obviously some exceptions to that. There's some leases that may be worth stepping into, and the terms are great, and you'd happily do it. But by and large, there's a lot of leases that would need to be negotiated, and the bankruptcy process does not require a landlord to negotiate a new lease. So often what you're doing in these processes is the bankruptcy trustee can reject the leases, and you are in the position of starting with square one with a landlord in negotiating for a brand new lease. From the landlord perspective, we're seeing a lot more willingness to have those conversations for obvious reasons, because they want a good tenant. They want any tenant to come in there. But again, it's going to be a conversation on a case-by-case basis with each landlord if you're doing that. Also, if the sale of alcohol is involved, it's really important to get a consultant in early that is experienced in handling licensing in whatever jurisdiction the location or locations are in, because those can get really complicated. And if selling alcohol is important to the continuance of the business, you will want to make sure that is handled appropriately. So just a few high-level points in terms of acquiring a business out of distress. We're seeing a lot more folks looking at negotiating deals and then going into bankruptcy, and then or actually buying businesses out of bankruptcy. So if you've identified any businesses, or if you're potentially considering going through a bankruptcy process, the DWT team would be happy to talk about that and answer more questions specifically. But we believe there are going to be a lot more opportunities out there to purchase brands, or to purchase stores of good brands that still have good value in a number of locations around the country. And I think we're going to see a fairly significant proliferation of purchases and sales over the forthcoming months, and probably some pretty good values out there. So with that, we will be holding a special webinar on that topic within the next week or so, and we will be sending information out to the group so we can discuss in more detail. Last week, we had Congressman Blumenauer on the phone to discuss the Restaurants Act of 2020. If you recall, that is a proposed piece of legislation supported by Congressman Blumenauer and supported by the Independent Restaurant Coalition, among with others. The proposal is a $120 billion grant program to restaurants that would really be focused on smaller chains and independent restaurants. As Congressman Blumenauer said, it's still very early in the process, and the bill is going through some revisions and changes before it gets to the next level. But it is certainly one to be on everybody's radar, as well as larger relief act proposed and supported by the National Restaurant Association, which is the $240 billion proposed plan. And I think what we're probably going to see, and hopefully see, is some level of collaboration between these groups, because and any other groups, because the odds of getting one bill passed are much greater than getting multiple bills passed, as we can all see what's going on with just amendments to the PPP program and everything else. It's a process in Washington to get anything passed. And so I believe we're going to be seeing more development on restaurant-friendly financial legislation over the next couple of weeks. We will keep everybody posted on that. We're involved. So please stay tuned and please stay active and supportive. To the extent you want to be active and involved, you can let me know personally in getting behind any of this legislation. We also, 2 weeks ago, we had Gwyneth Borden and State Senator Wiener from California on to discuss SB 939. That's the bill that would enable restaurants to terminate leases without penalty if they're unable to negotiate a new lease with their landlords or an amendment to their lease under certain circumstances. As drafted, it had to be a 40% or more drop in business due to COVID. That bill did pass the judiciary a week or so ago, and now it's going through an amendment process and on to the next phase. So we will keep everybody posted on where that is going. I know that a lot of people are actively following it in California and around the country because it has some obviously significant implications if this bill does pass as drafted. If you suffered a 40% more reduction in business, you were unable to negotiate a new lease with your landlord to your liking, you would be able to terminate that lease without any recourse, no corporate guarantees, no personal guarantees. So obviously that bill is generating a lot of attention. So with that, we're going to step into an update on everybody's most or least favorite topic over the last 2 months is the CARES Act. And PPP related updates. So Landis, Liz, we have you here. Landis?
Yes, absolutely, thank you. So as you noted, there have been a number of bills that have been proposed or considered. Now the good news is that the U.S. House of Representatives recently passed the Paycheck Protection Program Flexibility Act, H.R. 7010, with a bipartisan vote of 417-1, so passed overwhelmingly in the House. The U.S. Senate was previously considering an alternative bill that was a little less borrower favorable, and so there was some concern about whether the U.S. Whether the Senate was going to keep pushing for their version of the bill or just accept the House bill. But yesterday, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said that he hopes and anticipates the Senate will soon take up and pass the House bill. Those are his words. They would take up and pass the House bill. So, you know, with him being Senate Majority Leader, and now it has complete bipartisan support, it looks like it'll likely be signed into law. Now, in terms of the changes that will be implemented by this bill, most importantly, it changes the 75-25 payroll requirement to a 60-40 requirement for full loan forgiveness. So you only have to use 60% of the total forgivable amount for payroll expenses. This requirement has been particularly onerous in the restaurant industry, as we all know. Then the bill extends the loan use period from 8 weeks to 24 weeks, so you still start from the original loan grant date, but now it's a full 24-week period. The bill does give borrowers the flexibility if they would, for whatever reason, prefer to use the 8 week period, perhaps just to close it out and say, in some industries there aren't hit as bad as ours. But unless you opt for the 8 week period, you have for the full 24 weeks. Additionally, the new law extends the program expiration date from June 30th to December 31st. So folks can continue to make new applications for the loan if they have not yet done so all the way through the end of the year. It lengthens the loan terms for new loans from 2 years to 5 years. So if the amount of the loan that is not forgiven converts into an ordinary term loan. So for companies that have already applied for and received their PPP loans, the loan terms is still stuck at 2 years, but for new applications, it'll be 5 years. And finally, another big change was that the borrowers are allowed to defer the payroll taxes on the PPP loan proceeds themselves. This was a big headache for the accounting community in particular. So those are good signs, especially the bipartisan support, and it looks like the Senate and likely the president are going to agree with the more generous version of this bill. That's optimistic. There's also a sense that they, by extending the period for so long and the expiration date for so long, that they seem to want to have this be the last major extension. They don't, you know, they're concerned about doing an extension, then another one, then another one. So they're trying to capture the whole amount. They haven't provided any more guidance on the substantive terms in the last week, but I'm really excited about this.
Well, thank you, Landis. And I think these are all welcome developments for sure. It's nice to see progress being made to make this more flexible. I think this also underscores, though, the pain that everybody has endured with this act over the last couple of months, you know, how nice it would be to have an act that's really simple and that really hits the target. And that's where we're hoping, you know, this new proposed financial legislation or some combination of proposed legislation by the NRA and the IRC and Congressman Blumenauer comes together, because that's a, you know, as proposed, it's a grant program and a lot less complicated as drafted. You know, we know that obviously the devil's in the detail and things can get very different as they move along through the legislative process. But I think, you know, when you combine this and you combine a better, more simplified program, hopefully it will give the industry, you know, the support that it really needs to get through these next several months. So thank you, Landis. And also to note, we submitted our jobs memo to the city of Los Angeles. We're on a working committee there, multi-industry, have a number of proposals to support the restaurant industry. And if implemented there, perhaps in other parts of the country, we're optimistic we'll get some traction. And these are things that personally would never conceive would be possible prior to COVID. That if they are implemented, will provide some much added relief and benefits. Some things that are being proposed, in addition to, you know, some proposals that will make operating less expensive, are proposed moratoriums on certain types of litigation that have affected and impacted restaurateurs in California and elsewhere for a long time. So really looking at restaurants as a protected business to enable them to provide the jobs that are so desperately needed to bring everybody back to work. So we'll keep you posted on that as well. Now we'll go around our group. Our labor and employment team has been very busy since March, for obvious reasons, and with people, you know, being furloughed or you know, being transitioned out, to now a lot of folks being transitioned back in to dealing with, you know, even the more complicated issues that we've been working on the last week or so. So why don't we check in with you, Roy, in New York? How are things going there? Any new developments?
Hey, Riley. Yeah, a couple new things. In the regions of the state that are less populated, they've now entered phase two of the state's reopening plan. So they have 2 weeks to stay at phase two before they can enter phase three. And at that point, restaurants will be able to open under some regulations that the state hasn't published yet. But that's the phase for restaurants is phase three. And we should be there in a couple weeks again in some of the northern counties in New York. Long Island and Westchester County are now in phase one. They should be moving into phase two, hopefully in the next week or so. And New York City will be at phase one on June 8th. And hopefully the numbers and the metrics of COVID cases don't increase to the point that it delays New York City from moving to phase two and then eventually to phase three. But right now, it looks as though phase three won't be happening until at least after July 4th. Some good news, it appears that the New York City Council is not pushing as hard right now on the Essential Workers Bill of Rights that was proposed about 6 weeks ago, which included just cause discharge regulations as well as hazard pay. You know, it's still working its way through the city council, but it still has not been put up for a vote. And right now it's you know, fingers crossed, it's looking good that it may not come up for a vote. One other point, the New York State Restaurant Association is supporting a bill that's going to be heard on June 4th, seeking to streamline the process for restaurants to obtain permits to expand outdoor seating areas on sidewalks and streets. So that's something we'll keep an eye on, because that potentially could, you know, lead restaurants to be able to reopen sooner and be able to serve their customers on a quicker basis in New York City.
Well, thank you, Roy. And Janet, do we have you on in California?
You do have me on in California.
Hey, Janet. Welcome.
Hello.
You know, I know that the city of LA, in addition to releasing the guidelines last Friday and folks being given the ability to reopen, I know they are also looking to be very cooperative with outdoor dining and, you know, to be helpful in expediting anything, you know, on your end in that department.
Sure. The city is exploring outdoor dining into the streets in some areas. And so those plans haven't firmed up yet, but we're hoping to see actual street closures and restaurants being able to push their tables out into the streets. And then we do have some of our counties here in California already reopening restaurants for inside dining. I'm out here in Ventura at the moment, and we have about a third of our restaurants now opening for indoor dining with limited seating in accordance with the guidelines that the governor's set forth. But that's encouraging. Things are bustling out here. As just a side note, folks are anxious to get back to restaurants, and even where they're still closed for indoor dining, we're seeing a lot of people doing takeout. So we're hopeful that there's a resurgence here in California. On the labor front, there's not all that much to report. Things are kind of the way they are here in California. There's not really anything new on the horizon at this moment.
Well, thank you so much, Janet. And I would really like to thank our special guest today, Lee Main from Innovative Dining Group, and Martha Hoover from Patachu, for spending their time with us today and sharing their perspective and experience with all on the call. We'd like to thank everybody for joining in and thinking of you and your teams and your families as we work through what will be another difficult week, but lots of options in the restaurant industry and a lot of good reason to keep believing in an important industry. So thank you, everybody. We look forward to seeing